Hello, and welcome to this edition of Hometown Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, not your normal or regular host for the program, but I'm so happy to be hosting Hometown Alaska today because I have an exciting guest in the studio with me. Lee Newman is here to talk about her new book, Still Points North, One Alaska Childhood, One Grown-Up World, One Long Journey Home. Lee, hi.
Hi.
Thanks so much for being here. It's really great to have you in the studio. Too often we have to talk to folks on the phone, so it's really nice to have somebody in the studio with us. So we'll be inviting listeners to join us if they have questions, but first I'd like for us just to talk for a bit. Give our listeners a brief kind of an overview of your memoir. It starts with you visiting your dad in his new house, which is fairly empty of furniture. You're just a little girl, clearly manifesting stress and sorrow, anger, confusion over your parents' split. You have a bad rash, your hair is in rough shape. And you and your dad sort of skirt around discussing your new life situation. It's, you know, fishing like crazy rather than talking. Take it from there and tell us about that.
Well, yeah, the book begins, I mean, I consider the book very much a love letter to Alaska. And bizarrely, you know, it enters into a very difficult time period in my life. But I think that love often has its difficulties, you know. So the story starts with my dad and I the first summer that we spent without my mother. My mother had already left and actually taken me with her. And then I came back 6 months later. Yeah, 6 months later. And so I basically start talking about this very, very strange period that happens right after divorce, where I think that everybody's grieving in a very strange way. And interestingly enough, my dad and I chose to grieve through killing. We just procured. I think maybe in the lower 48, they're going to think that in a kind of a violent way. But it's also has a kind of great reassuring and comforting way, because we were killing food for ourselves. We were stocking up food, and we kept buying freezers and filling it up with more salmon. And I think if I'd stayed, we would have filled it up with caribou and moose. We just kept on stockpiling all this food. And that was our way of understanding or trying to get through probably the loneliest period of both of our lives.
And sort of controlling some aspect of your life when a lot of it probably felt sort of out of control at that point.
That's a really good point. It really was. I mean, I know that our universe was very small that summer. You know, it's not like we were living in Anchorage and we were flying out in the bush all the time. We were always fishing. It was just me and my dad. Sometimes, occasionally, it would be his best friend and his best friend's daughter. They would go with us, or his best friend's daughter would come with us. But mostly it was just me and my dad. And we would go places so far away, so off the grid. And you could do that. It was 1979, 1980. You know, there were places we'd go to and I'd see like a Pepsi can from like 19. It'd say the bicentennial. You know, and it'd be like really faded, and you'd never see another person. There's places, you know, we called the secret spot and Lake Nonami, and it was just us hanging out. It's not like we talked while we fished either. We just fished.
Mm-hmm. You know,
we just fished.
Well, would you mind reading a segment for us? The book, as we were talking before we went on air, the book is divided into two segments.
Right.
And the first part is you and your dad. And then the second part is more of your adult life. And we'll talk about that as we go forward. But read a section for us. I've been going through the book, marking all these great segments. And I love the one that you settled on. So please do.
Thanks. So this is taken from the end of that summer that my dad and I spent alone, where we just kept filling up the freezers. 1 week later, Dad and I start building smokers out of three old refrigerators from the Anchorage town dump. If we don't have room in the freezer to store all our fish, we can do like the natives do and dry it out for jerky. We saw holes in the tops of refrigerators to let the smoke escape, insert pans of burning hickory chips in the produce doors. On the racks, we lay out strips of fresh, raw red salmon. That thinly sliced, the meat turns jeweled and see-through. I hold pieces over my eyes, thinking it will turn the world pink like sunglasses. By the last week of August, hot black clouds billow over the roof of our house and our backyard starts sliding into the lake. The smokers are going full blast on the driveway, puffing salmon grease into the cool, autumn-smelling wind. Meanwhile, the muddy lot on which our house is built keeps slipping inch by inch into the water. We forgot to plant grass or trees or anything with roots to prevent erosion. As the mud moves, long, thin cracks split up our kitchen walls. The tiles on the floor buckle. My father puts me in charge of the smokers, then goes back to the dump for railroad ties. He drags them one by one, each an 8.5-foot-long tie weighing about 250 pounds, down to the lake himself, rolling them into the water off the bank. Up in the garage, I sit around lonely and bored. My hands stink of rotten fish. Flies bite my ankles. The smoker door is stuck, I call out to Dad, who is now diving into the lake, trying to lift the railroad ties, one on top of another, underwater, to build us a retaining wall. I can't find the spatula, I say. Look by the ice auger, Dad says. I can't find the bag of hickory chips. Honey, Dad says, standing up with weeds hanging off his ears. For Christ's sake, imagine you're on a desert island. I stomp off to the kitchen, leaving all our fish to burn. My father is stupid. My father is a jerk. I look up at the fridge. My airplane ticket is still there, under the calendar magnet where it has been all summer. Dad and I are already on a desert island, aren't we? We've been there for a while, fishing and flying and eating and smoking and grilling and piling railroad ties into walls, while the rest of the world has been buying new backpacks and hemming new jeans, plus doing all the summer reading that I haven't even looked at yet. I jump up and slide the airplane ticket down to eye level. Northwest Orient, it says, across the thick red packet. In a few days, I'll be going back to Baltimore, back to my mother, in school, and my new life outside. And Dad will be staying here in our house, sleeping in his down sleeping bag, eating all our salmon all winter all by himself. Inside the packet is a bundle of thin, bound, smeary carbon paper. The ticket. I sniff it, then lick the purple-black ink that rubs off on my fingers. The ticket cost $1,000. If I rip it up, I'll have to pay Dad back that $1,000, the way I had to pay him back the $9 for the Bonnie Bell lip glosses that I stole one time when I was 7. I slide the ticket back under the magnet and leave it on the fridge. When Dad takes me to the airport, he walks me all the way down to the plane and straps me into his seat. His face goes red and squishy. Huge, racking sobs burst out of him. He hugs me again. It's not even like in the bathroom when he cried, and it was only us two, and we could pretend it wasn't happening. I look around the airplane. An old lady is staring at us. Another one is looking straight ahead so as not to stare at us. The stewardess tugs on his arm. I try to hug Dad back, but that only makes him hug me harder. I have a horrible feeling about what's about to happen. Already, in fact, I can feel it happening. The smile widening across my face, a huge, toothy zinger. The last and only time I ever smiled like this was 2 years before, the night our old house caught on fire from the stove and the kitchen burned down. Dad ran around, beating the fire out with blankets while Mom cried in the corner, and I smiled like a jack in the jack-in-box and didn't move and didn't help and did nothing to help. I wanted to help. A voice in my head was saying, "At least stop smiling." But my face was rubbery and stuck, and when I tried to move, I couldn't figure out what to do. Run to the closet for coats, or to the bathroom for towels, or fill up some cups and throw water, or hide from the fire and Dad and Mom in the family room under the Afghan on the couch. This time, though, I can do something, because I'm coming back to Alaska, and not just for Christmas or next summer. There is a clause in the custody agreement that requires me to come up to Anchorage and live with my dad for one full year when I'm 12. After that, I'm supposed to go back and live with Mom again. But I'm not going to. I'm not sure how yet. I've been working on some scenarios like getting lost in the bush and then hiding out for a while, just long enough for everybody to give up looking for me, except for Dad and Mom. A few of the specifics need ironing out. Fact one, 12 years old is a long way off. 4 huge, never-ending years from now. Fact two, I'll have to get lost in early June so I can get back inside a house by September. Fact three, I'll have to figure out how to protect myself out there, with a gun maybe, which I don't know how to use, and I'll have to steal from Dad. Not to mention, where in the bush should I hide? Someplace like Chugach National Forest, outside Anchorage, which I can get to on my bike, or someplace farther out, like Beluga, which means getting lost from Dad while we're fishing. The letter idea seems a little too scary. Then again, it would be the ideal setting for Mom and Dad to realize as they chop through the alders calling out my name that they made a mistake, that I have to live in Alaska, and Mom has to live here with me, and Dad has to live with here with the two of us the way we did before. None of which I can tell Dad. Not while he's sobbing still, and I'm smiling, smiling like his crying is funny instead of loud and embarrassing and scary. I unbuckle my seatbelt and stand up. I start to hug him one last time, but that won't work. If I hug him, he'll only hug me back and not let go. So I stick out my hand, an unconscious and unplanned gesture, a firm, welcoming handshake of the kind that my Swiss headmistress in Baltimore gives to each girl in the morning as we enter the double doors of school.
If you're just joining us, this is Hometown Alaska. I'm the host today, Lori Townsend, filling in. And my guest is Lee Newman, who Lee was just reading from her new book, Still Points North. That passage is really powerful in kind of setting the tone for the struggles that you were having. It's such a burden for a child to sometimes be placed in that position where you're almost like the parent, where here your dad is kind of melting down and, you know, for a lot of reasons, of course, but you have to sort of put on this persona of being in control and being okay.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know whether I had to, you know, because I think that regardless, this happened because we had this divorce situation. And also my mother went on to have some mental issues that are described in the book as she was leaving, which I think contributed towards what was happening in my family. But I think at any child's life, there comes that moment where things get too much for parents. Like something happens, a grandparent dies, or, you know, the money is lost and the parents fall apart. And the child does have a choice. You know, the child can collapse also and cry or run away or for some, whatever reason. And I do think this maybe relates to having grown up in Alaska, spent lots of time in the bush, in the wilderness, and the kind of self-reliance that my dad was sort of teaching me all along, always, maybe not with his directions, but with his actions. You know, I was always modeling that. You know, my dad never treated me like a little girl that had to sit at home. He was always teaching me how to, you know, chop my own firewood, stack that own firewood. Okay, we need an outhouse. Well, you have to help me dig it. You've got to put the lime on it. And furthermore, you have to help me take a styrofoam thing and make it so that you can sit on it. I mean, I had to pump out the floats. So I had to put fuel in the plane. I mean, he always treated me as though I was a little mini 40-year-old man or something at his side, you know, and I was 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 or 11 or 12. And it's actually a wonderful way to grow up. But I don't know whether it gives you full access to sorrow or to the expression of sorrow. I do know that you know, in later parts of the book, this self-reliance, which I do think is an incredible Alaskan quality, I see it in so many Alaskan people, especially those my age, because everybody I knew grew up in a very similar kind of way, you know, whether they grew up completely in town or all in the bush or between the two. But it leads to enormous personal strength. And I think that the only problem happens when you're having to involve other people, other people in your self-reliance. When your self-reliance bumps up against the inevitable reality that great, great happiness occurs when you connect with other human beings.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us now, this is Hometown Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. My guest is Lee Newman, and we're discussing her new book, Still Points North. And you can join the conversation if you'd like. If you have a question for our guest, Lee Newman, today, did you grow up in a geographically challenged family, or are you raising children of your own, perhaps within that setting? You can join us at 550-8433, or if you're out of the Anchorage area, the number is 888-353-5752, and you can also send us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. Do you still see that little girl sometimes when you're thinking back of those days of, or has she sort of resolved that pain that was there then?
Well, when I wrote the book, you know, I went right, I hadn't, you know, looked back. I was not a natural memoirist and I'm not a natural sharer, you know, so that was a big leap. I wrote the book sort of with the you know, denial is denial is unbelievable reliable. It's just so reliable. Denial is a wonderfully reliable quality of the human spirit. And it came through with me in spades. It just stayed by my side as I wrote the book. But it did require me, as I wrote the book, to go back to those days. I mean, I just rolled the tape. I rolled the tape and I went, and I had been rolling the tape for years in my mind. What I did was just write it down this time. And so, but I wrote it at a period of my life where I had already become a parent and I had founded my own family. And I had gone through this experience with my husband that I talk about, this love story with my husband, where I had married him and then quite frankly, I left him right away, probably because of issues of like not trusting people or being very afraid of marriage and family and feeling that I couldn't do it or how do you know when you're supposed to do it? And having gone through all that with him, I think it enabled me to look back on the story of what happened with my own parents and with myself with a lot of forgiveness and understanding and a great deep desire to make some sense out of this, which is what a memoir does. It kind of makes a narrative arc out of all these collective experiences. And I felt like I had walked away with a kind of roadmap on the way I want to live for the rest of my life. Unexpectedly. I never went in there with that plan. You know, I just went in like, hey, let's tell a good story about fishing and hunting.
You know, that's really interesting to hear that you've been a writer for many years,
yeah.
Visited countries around the world as a travel writer. You've written fiction, essays, short stories, and then this very public telling of some very private aspects of your life and family. Some, lots of it actually, quite painful.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of courage to lay, you know, one's own story out on the table for public consumption and scrutiny.
Yeah.
Was this an effort to sort of figure it out yourself or
no,
why did you decide to tell it?
I tell you, I came out of it because I had tried to I had never written anything personal. I had never written a personal essay before this project. And the project halfway through, I did write a personal essay that appeared in the New York Times that did very, very well. And I felt like I was on the road to something. But what happened was I had written a novel that took me 3 or 4 years to write, and it wasn't any good. I don't know if you've ever embarked on a creative project that has exploded in your face and left you wiping black ashes off your cheeks. But that was it.
Yes.
That was the one. And at the end of it, I knew, I mean, one thing, again, this is like a very, you know, one thing my dad always taught me, like when we were in the bush, was it's like all about decision making, right? So the plane has loosened, it's floating down the river. Like you need to make a decision, you need to keep making decisions. You need to dive into the water and swim as fast as you can. If you cannot catch the plane, then you need to try and figure out, you know, you need to get the daughter to run on the bank and see if she can jump in. So you have to keep making decisions until you solve the problems that you're in. And I knew at that point when my novel had failed, to me, it doesn't sound so traumatic in life, especially when you think about life and death in the bush. It's a book. It didn't work. But for me, that was a very public failure. You know, I felt that I couldn't write, that I was a failure. And I was beginning to fall into a pretty bad depression. And when I made a decision, I said, well, I got to write something else. I can't write a novel because I'm too afraid. I don't want to write stories, short stories. They take too long for me. Okay, I'll just write about my child and see what happens. Well, the minute I started writing about my childhood, it was sort of like I've been going behind donkeys for like the past 4 years. All of a sudden, I had a team of white horses with little bells. They were just running through the snow. All I had to do was go. The writing just started going, and I knew it. Like the way I was playing with language, I felt just, it was, I couldn't wait to sit down, although I didn't want to sit down because it was painful, but I couldn't wait to sit down, that kind of. So I thought, well, I have to keep going. And then I didn't think any further than that. I just didn't think any further than the first, you know, second page or the next page or the next page. Hmm.
Your dad is such an interesting character because he is a doctor, a surgeon.
Yeah.
So certainly a man that wouldn't have had to do things like make smokers out of old refrigerators or haul his own timbers into the water. He could have hired someone to do those things.
I know.
But he's sort of the quintessential Alaskan in that respect. Even though he had the means to do things differently, he chose to just get in there and do them himself. And How, you know, that seems to have kind of informed the way you've been able to bring yourself through the turmoil and just kind of forge ahead.
Well, I think that, I mean, I actually think of most Alaskans as kind of Renaissance people. You know, my dad is a quintessential example of that. You know, came up in the early 70s, got up here, never left, loved it. And that meant, you know, he could play the piano. He can, you know, cook incredible food on his own. Loved fine wine at the same time. Can hunt a caribou, field dress it himself, make his own sausages, repack his own shotgun shells. You know what I mean? Like,
and perform surgery.
Yeah, and perform surgery. You know, like, it's very interesting. But I don't, and I love him, and he's my father. And I this book is very much an homage to him and everything he taught me and everything that Alaska taught us. But I, even as an adult, I have to admit there's probably other men like him up here. I don't want anybody to be as great of a hero as he was to me, but I have met many other incredibly capable and competent Alaskans. I do think because the state affords a freedom of A, being successful on a professional level, and it also affords a precedent of being, there is room to explore and do so many things. You know, you can live any kind of life you want. You might want to build your own fly rod if you're living in, you know, San Francisco, but, you know, it's going to take 2 hours to go get to a stream and use it. And, you know, you're going to need a garage, and the garage is going to cost you $500,000. I mean, here you can really do things that you want to do. And, you know, I'm the same way. You know, I don't live in Alaska anymore, but my dad taught me, like, to live that way, and I still do. I mean, no matter what, I was a travel writer. That's how I made my living from basically age 23 to 34 when I had my first child. And I do talk about it in the book. And you know, I would go to the, some of my assignments were like, I would be sent to Norway to live with the Samis near the North Pole. Mm. And just would live with the Samis in their, like, kind of teepee yurt thing, sleeping on pine boughs and, you know, herding reindeer. And basically my job, my big tough job, was to collect the lingonberries off the they give me a coffee can every day. I'd collect the lingonberries. I thought, okay, good, I'm good at following instructions.
Well, and you know how to pick berries, certainly.
Yeah, no, no, that's right. My dad would say, go pick the berries. These people say, go pick the berries. Okay, got that, no problem.
If you'd like to join our conversation today, you're welcome to call in or send an email. 550-8433 is the local number, 1-888-353-5752, or hometown at alaskapublic.org. You talked about sort of being able to really rush through into writing this, but how long did it take? Was it sort of simmering in the back of your mind for a long time, or did it just sort of come all at once when you were writing?
No, it didn't come all at once. It took 4 years. By going behind four horses, you know, at the same time, you know, writing a memoir is really, really difficult because you write everything and then you have to piece it together about what's really important. And I knew, as I wrote the whole book, I didn't know what I was writing about. I just blurted it. And then as the more I wrote, I began to realize that there was something I really wanted to talk about, which is this sort of improbable comfort of loneliness, this culture of loneliness that developed. For me, living between my mom and dad, who were 5,000 miles apart, flying between them every 3 months from age 7 until 21, and then living as a travel writer, basically living on the road, doing, you know, living in very extreme environments, and then coming back to New York for maybe a couple weeks. You know, and I had a house that was not unlike my dad's house.
Yes, no furniture.
I had a blank apartment with a mattress on the floor and an answering machine. And I think that I'm an extreme example, but I don't think I'm an anomaly. I think that there's a lot of people out there that are functioning on a high level, and how we sort of keep going and we actually look even great to other people as we go, you know, as we're tracking tigers in Nepal, or we're founding our second dentist office, or we're, you know, learning our Pilates, you know, certificate. And then we're going home to, like, this empty house, and, you know, and it's we know that something's wrong, but it's oddly comforting. Hmm. We don't know what to do. It's like, it's discomfort and comfort at the same time. It's managing that and addressing it and trying to find some way out of it.
We are going to take just a short break. You're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Lori Townsend. KSKA Spring Membership Drive is this week. KSKA is member-supported radio. Remember, programs like Hometown Alaska rely on your financial support. And here's Terry Gross, host of Fresh Air, to tell you more.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. Every day, KSKA, APRN, and NPR are here for you. Stop and think a moment about who pays for it. Over 70% of KSKA's funding comes from here in South Central Alaska. That includes support from local businesses, from our nonprofit clients, and from you listening right now to KSKA. Every listener plays a vital role in shaping the future of KSKA and NPR. Today, it's time to pledge financial support, so KSKA and NPR are here for you tomorrow. Please go to alaskapublic.org. It's fast and easy. KSKA's membership drive is in full swing, and the less time we spend on air asking for your support, the more time we can devote to great programming, like Fresh Air, all things considered. Please support KSKA today online at alaskapublic.org. KSKA, life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.
And this is Hometown Alaska. And I'm Lori Townsend, your guest for today. And my guest in the studio is Lee Newman, who has written a fascinating book, Still Points North, One Alaskan Childhood, One Grown-Up World, One Long Journey Home. And you can join us if you have questions, if you grew up in a divided family, or perhaps you're raising children in a similar situation. 550-8433. Or outside of Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752, or email us, hometown@alaskapublic.org. Lee, did you tell your family that you were writing the book while you were in process, or did you just sort of write it and say, here it is?
Oh, no, I told them all the way through, but I think that, you know, since I didn't know what I was writing, I kept saying, I'm going to write this memoir about my Alaskan childhood. And I really did think I was writing a book about fishing and hunting. You know, I mean, and I'd call up my dad and I'd say, oh, what was it, Crow Pass we were on where we almost, you know, fell into the crevasse of the glacier? Or, hey, where was that, you know, brown bear that, you know, that rummaged through our cooler? And, you know, and my dad was helping me, and he just said, go ahead and write whatever you're going to write. It's a memoir, you know, and we'll deal with it later. When I finished the book, I gave a draft of the book both to my mother and my father before I gave it to my editor at Random House. It's published with Random House Dial, which is the same sort of house. And I had a wonderful editor, but I wanted my parents to read it and feel okay about it. And I even said, you know, I knew I wasn't fully aware of what I'd written. That sounds so impossible to believe, but I just didn't know what I'd written kind of fully. And I was, we had a lot of talks because I had never really spoken about my childhood.
What do you mean you didn't know what you'd written as far as the impact it might have on your family?
Right. Yeah, it was a very personal story. I had been written for most of it. I have a full-time job, so I'd written it at 4 o'clock in the morning by myself in the dark and finished by 7 to get up my kids and get them ready, and then went to work. And I didn't really talk about it with other people. And so we had a lot of talks, A, about the past and what had happened. And then we also had a talk about, you know, whether I should publish it or not. Because as I wrote the book, I began to understand my family and my parents so much more. Hmm. And I wrote the book very much. I kind of fell in love with my family, even though as improbable as it sounds, I fell in love with my family as I wrote the book. I began to understand my parents as complicated human beings and like why they had made certain choices, you know, why their marriage had fallen apart, why my mom moved 5,000 miles away. And when she did, she moved kind of dramatically, driving out of Alaska and all the way across the country, dipping into Mexico. I mean, it took us several months to get to Baltimore. And the legacy of my mother's family, which was basically of lots and lots of mental illness and state asylums and so on. And, you know, we all decided that I should publish the book. My parents both decided at the end that they supported me and they loved me and they were going to be behind me. And that doesn't mean we're all going to be, you know, on TV. You know, that's not going to happen. You know, we live in a quiet family, but they let me do this and I'll love them even more for the rest of my life.
Do you think that part of the reason that it felt the way that it did to you was because of the point that you were at in your life? You were a parent yourself, and you know, we're so critical of our parents when we're kids because they don't, you know, they're always doing things the wrong way. And then when we're older and parents ourselves, it's like, oh, wait a minute, now I get it.
Well, I'm not sure. Like, I think growing up with my dad being such a powerful figure, I don't know whether I was critical of him. I know I was hurt and lost, and I know that we had never talked about what had happened in a really kind of comprehensive way. And that had gone on for years and years and years. And so there was a dialogue in my head. And I knew that story was flawed. that story is, you know, that story is the one where you're the, always the good one and everybody else is hurting and monkeying with you, right? And that's just not reality. It's just not. And it was interesting as I started to write the book, and the reason I was having so much fun about it was coming directly to that Alaskan tradition of campfire stories. You know, I'd sit down and I'd start talking about, you know, the time, well, there's many times we almost die in the book, you know, where this updraft takes my dad and I on this airplane up to 20,000 feet. We didn't have enough oxygen. I looked over, my dad had never said this to me. He looked over and said, "I think we might be in trouble." And we'd almost died a lot of times. He'd never said that to me. And I said, "Well, how do you know when you're in trouble?" I think I was 11. And he goes, "Your lips turn blue." Well, I looked down at that moment. I saw my hands were blue. And I saw his lips were blue. And at that moment, we both started giggling because we had lost oxygen.
Right.
Then we were laughing and giggling and laughing. And we did hit 20,000 feet. That's not supposed to happen. Your plane's supposed to fall out of the sky. And Dad pointed the nose of the plane directly down at the ground, trying to fight this updraft, hoping that we would just go straight down towards the ground, which probably would have killed us if we had gone straight down. What happened was this downdraft. We hit a downdraft. A very gentle downdraft pulled us down, and we didn't pass out. We didn't fall out of the sky. We didn't go straight down an auger end. You know, we just sort of floated downward, sort of like a little feather. And I don't know where I'm going with this, but those experiences sort of...
Well, if nothing else, they helped you realize I can survive quite a bit.
Yeah, it was very much about physical survival. And I realized as I wrote the book, that kind of mentality, you know, is kind of an exaggerated but crucial forming part of this self-reliance thing where you literally understand what survival is. I think people, like, they often talk about survival as a metaphorical thing, and I'm not doubting that it is. But there actually also is real survival.
Yes. You know? Being able to keep your head in a moment of
and
what panic would kill
fear,
you.
Right.
Yes.
And I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's a great thing. I don't know how it always translates into regular life, which is what I think I was always struggling with. Somehow this real survival, literal survival on the bush, combined also with this sort of family divorce, kind of as a instead of a perfect storm of how I have to be by myself at all time and you can't trust anybody ever. I just always have to keep making decisions and keep going forward.
Yeah.
You know?
The idea of survival segues nicely into this email that we did receive here at Hometown Alaska. Writer of the email, Joanna, says, "I loved this book. It seems to me that Lee learned all she needed from her father to survive and thrive in this world. Life is a series of compromises, and Lee has handled hers well. I hope her father is extremely proud of her. I know I would be if she were my daughter. I anxiously await her next book." So,
thank you. My God, that's an email you want to get. I think I'm going to have to print that one out, except for it's on my own computer.
Send it to you, and
please
you can
do.
Certainly have that email.
Well, it's nice to hear that. You know, I mean, I grew up always dreaming that I would live here. I'd have this cabin. You know, I went to Scenic Park Elementary, and I have a collage that I found. It had a little cutout picture of my, like a woman with brown hair, I guess that it was mom, and then a cutout picture of a dad, and then a cutout picture of me, and I guess somehow I cut out a magazine picture of a husky dog. My husky dog was named Baby when I was a kid, and then I had drew a little log cabin, you know, because I guess they don't have log cabins in magazines, you know,
yeah.
That was my collage. And I really did think that for my whole life, like that was going to be how it ended up for me. You know, I ended up meeting this guy and we would go to the woods and we would live there with our husky dog. And that was your happily ever after, the sort of the picket fence thing that you read about in the lower 48, except for I didn't know what a picket fence was then, you know, and
there you were.
Yeah, I didn't know. And it's been a really wonderful process to realize what home can be. You know, home can be Alaska, and it can be Baltimore with your mom, and it can be Seattle with your nana, and it can be New York with the guy that you married that loves New York.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's with the people that you love. They're all and honestly, like that Alaska thing always went with me everywhere I went.
This is Hometown Alaska, and I'm Lori Townsend. My guest today is Lee Newman. We're discussing her fascinating book, Still Points North. You can join us if you have a question, 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752, or you can email us, hometown@alaskapublic.org. Lee, fiction certainly can't match reality most of the time, and your life went from trips on planes and wild places to hunt and fish, and chasing around fairly freely with neighborhood kids, sort of how I grew up,
yeah.
to this total divide in which you lived in Alaska part of the time with your dad and in Baltimore with your mom, going to a private school that was very yeah. disciplined and regimented. Looking back, was this ultimately a really good thing because of the diversity, or was it sort of like being run through the ringer?
You know, I don't ever, I think when you're looking back, you can't even put them into those camps. I mean, I think I used to, but I don't, and it, you know, I really don't think you can. You just, it's like trying to understand why, when someone does something bad to you, right, and you say, oh, maybe she did it because she was insecure, or maybe because she was tired. I think at the end, you just have to say, oh, well, she did it. Same thing, like, this is what happened. You know, my life split in two this way. And there are enormous advantages of it. You know, I think I had some kind of learning disability when I arrived in Baltimore with my mother and was put into a private girls' school on the East Coast. I did not know how to read very well. Pretty much didn't know how to read. I'd like to say very well, but I really couldn't read very well. I had limited math skills. And I was someone who learned to love school because I had these amazing teachers who were in this all-girls school who'd probably never met anybody like me. And they spent all this time and energy on me. And I learned to love school, and I learned to go to a great college. And a lot of my life was determined by that intervention. On the other hand, as a social person, I completely wholesale failed in the Baltimore. You know, we were living in a Baltimore society where people owned horses and saddles, and they were debutantes and they were cotillions. And, you know, when they asked you their name, they really meant they were asking the name of your family. That was sometimes your middle name. I didn't even know the rules. So that was not so great. Mm-hmm. But boy, did it prepare me for the larger world outside of Alaska.
Absolutely.
I mean, you really, you know, when I went out to the larger world, I was ready to go to France, and I was ready to meet people that were gonna think of different things than I would think of when they met me.
Or pick berries with the Sami people.
Exactly. They really liked me. We had a good time.
We do have a caller on the air. Jeanette is with us from Anchorage, and she says she grew up similarly, but in Michigan. Hi, Jeanette.
Oh. Hi.
Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Lori. I started listening to you, and I said, oh, my God, it kind of sounds like me. But my situation was, there was six of us in the family. We grew up in Michigan in farm country. And at age 10, I started babysitting, making my own money. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know enough just to babysit. I washed the kids, give them a bath, wash their hair, did the laundry, read them a story, popcorn, put them to bed, and then I cleaned the house, did the dishes and the laundry. So, I mean, I thought that's what you do, you know? Kids' bedtime, what you're going to sit there. So I did stuff, which consequently, I got many, many babysitting jobs.
Yeah.
I had tons. I had a lot of money when I was 10, 11, and 12.
So you survived on babysitting.
I did, and then at age 10, my mom did not buy me school clothes. She did not buy me pencils and compasses and whatever the heck you need. And, you know, other kids would take a note home and say, Mom, I need this. Oh, I just read it and bought it myself, you know, whatever I needed.
Oh, yeah, Jeanette, I know.
My mother and father had problems. Mm. I mean, my father drank and abused my mother, and there was a lot of chaos in the house. So it was like, rather than add to it, I just did my own thing, you know?
Well, that's definitely a survival mechanism, too, is just kind of, you know, people that have that ability to sort of forge ahead on their own. Similar,
right.
And Lee, you did a lot of that.
In my 20s, I drove up to Alaska, and then I would take vacations and go to Belize and Guatemala and, you know, Jamaica and stuff like that. I would travel like that. I wasn't a writer, per se, like you, but...
No, but, I hear all these parallels. Like, you know, in the book, I do talk about I did the same thing that you did at starting at age 10. You know, when my mom left my dad, she struggled with, she was having a little bit of a breakdown and real problems with depression. And add to that, she had kind of a compulsive spending problem. So we ran out, and with the limited income of a divorced mother with a child, we ended up in a lot of scrapes money-wise. And I quickly learned at age 10, I was working too. By age 12, I had my first job, and I worked every day after school at a children's bookstore. I was a grocery store clerk. In the summertime, I would come up here and work in restaurants, 2-3 different jobs, trying to make enough money so that exactly when those things happen, when the school sent home a field trip note and you needed $10 to be on the bus, I had my own $10. You know, when I needed school shoes, I would go get my own. I would figure out the L.L. Bean catalog and send away for the shoes and buy them myself. And it's an education.
Mm-hmm. My girlfriends complain about it. I would just shake my head. I said, well, just go buy them, you know?
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much, Jeanette, for calling in and sharing your story with us. And other callers out there or other listeners out there, if you'd like to join us, please do. 550-8433 in the local Anchorage area, or 888-353-5752, or email hometown@alaskapublic.org. When you were writing the book, mm-hmm. and especially in light of the fact that you knew you had to let your parents read this, was it, did you have to fight against the desire at all to homogenize it, especially when you have children of your own and thinking about, okay, they're going to be reading this, and it's not like a, you know, there's horrible family secrets or anything, but there's a lot of pain in there. And
there was I was lucky in the sense, you know, I'm not lucky. Well, I was lucky. Like I read a lot of memoirs, and it's like this horrible mother who, you know, gets her kids hooked on meth, and the narrator never speaks to the mother again. And I came from this advantage of actually having two parents that loved me. And even though we had all of these problems, we had divorce, we had mental illness, we had some alcohol abuse, we had this crazy childhood where things went, you know, not so wrong. A lot of things also went right, you know. And so my rule and my thinking was the whole time that I wanted to celebrate what was wonderful about it and what they had given me. You know, my mom actually, despite of all these problems that we're talking about, was an incredibly strong figure. I mean, even for just to leave my dad, to get in that car after 13 years of marriage with a 6-year-old kid or a 7-year-old kid, you know, go all that 5,000 miles away to a hometown where she knew no one. Her mom had already been put in an insane asylum. My mom was raising me on her own, doing the best job she could. You know, that's pretty heroic. Mm-hmm. And she was a social worker. She went in and helped disadvantaged people in the poorest and most dangerous parts of Baltimore. That, to me, is heroic. I really did see both my parents as heroic figures. You know, my dad had this phrase, and I do talk about in the book, where he's always like, can't live on Woad Street.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he said anytime I had a problem. I go, oh, Dad, I can't fillet that fish, or Dad, I can't shoot that kid. Can't live on Woad Street. Check your home address.
You're not there.
You're not there, sweetie.
You talk about your mom's struggles with mental health issues.
Yeah.
There's a very painful story about your mom and blueberry muffins when it's like the first time that you as a young teenager get to bring young people home with you. And reading that, my heart just broke for you because I just thought, oh, will you describe that, please?
Yeah, you know, I think it had been going on for a long time, but I think my mom had been getting steadily worse, you know, for quite a while. So the story takes place when I'm 14 or 15. But I think it really started to get bad when I was about 10 or 11. Mm-hmm. But I just didn't compare it to anyone. And I didn't have anybody to talk to. And I certainly, when I'm living between the two parents, I really didn't discuss my mother with my father or my father with my mother. I just didn't. It was like two separate lives. Mm-hmm. When I was in with my mom, I was with my mom. And when I was with my dad, I was with my dad. And so I had never brought friends over really home before, and I tried to at 14 or 15 bring over some friends to play the guitar on the front porch. And my mom, I don't know, she just kind of dissolved into this almost like, it's hard to explain when you see someone have a break with reality, where she became like a 6-year-old and kept coming out and asking everybody over and over again if anybody wanted a blueberry muffin, which didn't make any sense. I don't even know if we had any blueberry muffins. But she was asking each one, and she would go back into the house, and then she'd wait 1, 2, 3, and then she'd come back and say, does anybody want a blueberry muffin? And it went on for forever, because actually teenagers who can be so incredibly cruel, they were all kind of going along with it. Like everyone just kept hoping it would resolve itself and stop, but it didn't. It just kind of kept going on until they left, which was which was a good thing that they left. And I, and actually, you know, you think if you see all these horrible teenagers portrayed in the movies, you know, there were very tough girls and very mean and very elitist girls at that school, but nobody ever made fun of me. That did not get around school. I was not mocked for that. I don't know why. I think sometimes maybe when teenagers brush up against something that's really scary, they can actually be nice about it versus like you're wearing the wrong kind of shirt or shoes.
Are you sure it wasn't just because they knew you were from Alaska and knew how to shoot a caribou and they were afraid you might beat them up if they made fun of you?
Wouldn't that have been great? I didn't think of telling them that. That's what I should have done. Let's go upstairs and look at my shotgun collection. Boy, I would have been arrested there.
When you visit Anchorage now, what are the feelings that come up for you? Have you made peace with that sad part of your childhood?
Totally. I mean, I haven't, you know, I don't know whether you make peace. Everyone wants to say at the end of it, there's something called a catharsis. I'm never very comfortable with that word. I think the thing is, and another word that I have trouble with is like forgiveness, as if I would be in a position to forgive my parents or they forgive me. Or I don't really see it that way, but I do know that I have let go of what the kind of self-torment that I was, inserting into my experience. Boy, that's a really awkward way of saying a lot of tangled feelings I'd have whenever I'd fly into town. I have let go of all that stuff, you know. I think I really was very upset with my father because basically we had not talked about what happened when my parents broke up and when he remarried. My dad went on to remarry and have children and a new family and really move on in a very happy way from his life, which I could see was happy. I always wanted my dad to have great experiences, and he did. He went on and had a very fulfilling, great family. But that wasn't, you know, I wasn't part of that family. Those kids were 12 or 16 years younger than me. And he didn't know what was going on with my mom, and I didn't tell him. So I think that at some point you have to come to a reckoning with yourself in the part of all these family dynamics. You have to come to a reckoning with what happened, and you have to come to a reckoning of how long you're just going to be angry at these people, because it's exhausting. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? It's like when you look at people who are alcoholics, you think, how can you keep that up? That is so exhausting. How do you get up every morning after you drink all that? You know,
right.
How do you get up every morning when the first thing you do is you lie in bed and you go through the bad memories of when you were 8? That's exhausting.
It is. But there had to be, you were an adult before your father sort of blurted out during a meal out, of all places.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we wish people would do things the way that we think would be the best, but of course that's not how life is.
No.
Things just happen when they happen.
No, but he was helping with my own divorce. What happened was there was a trigger event, right? Something always happens where people get to emerge and help you, right? I mean, I was in a tricky place where I'd left my husband, and I think he knew what that was. I think he knew what it was like to want to leave a marriage. And he supported me fully. You know, and my dad doesn't always support me. You know, he loved me and he'll get behind me and he'll help me. But he doesn't always say, oh, that was a great idea. You know, he's
a
tough,
dad.
Smart Alaskan dad. I'll be like, you're being a ding dong. You know, you just entered the ding dong factory and it's time you leave, sweetheart. But, you know, when I left my husband, he didn't even take a beat. You know, he said, I'm going to help you. We will get you an apartment up here. We'll get you a condo up here in Anchorage. We'll get you some furniture. You know, you can come live with us. I'll get you a plane. I'll teach you. We'll finally get your pilot's license. We're going to rebuild a new life for yourself. He didn't even ask any questions about why. You know, he just said, hey, I'm here for you. And I think that to me was the gesture that I had been waiting for my whole life, was somebody to say, hey, I'm going to take care of you. You know how we're talking about all that self-reliance? You know, it's a great quality. It's a wonderful thing. But sometimes when that person comes and says, I'm going to take care of you, honey.
That
you know,
feels good. Yeah.
It's like standing in a puddle of maple syrup. You know what I mean?
That's right. How did you recreate the story with such incredible detail? The detail is amazing. It puts us right there with you. Did you keep diaries? Because I'm thinking about the stressful parts of your childhood, which... Mm-hmm. Stress can either really cement things in your mind, or it can just block a lot of stuff out, where people have a hard time remembering stressful events sometimes. How did you construct this so detailed memoir?
Well, I think that everybody's imagination has a natural slot. And so the parts in the book that I wrote about, you know, were when I'm basically, you know, a very young child till about age 12. There are a few flashbacks to high school. And then we touch on my, you know, late 20s and my husband. And those are parts that really fascinated me. What doesn't fascinate me as much is the teenage years. I think I did block some of those things out. Those were the hardest and the darkest periods, mm-hmm. especially I was spending a lot of time with my mom and things were exceptionally stressful. My dad had his new family and I was really on my own, but not cute anymore, you know, not. And, you know, when you're cute and you're little and you're on your own, people, you know, kind of pick you up. And when you're older and you're angry and you're on your own, well, it's just not so fun. So I did block out some of those things. But I also think that growing up in a wilderness environment does something about the way you process your existence. I can't explain that except for that, you know, you're not in front of the TV, right? You're sitting in the mud, sometimes for hours. And for me, you know, I'd sit in the mud. I'd pretend to fish for a while, you know, then I'd sit in the mud. I'd find some snail or I'd find some dead fish guts. Then I'd start, you know, braiding the fish guts, you know, something like that. Taking the spinal bones, like making some kind of jewelry out of them, poking it with, you know, this mermaid foam, you know, poking the mermaid foam, lose a boot, you know what I mean? End up really cold. So, you know, that kind of, it was always part of my consciousness. I was just writing about what I did all the time. That was sort of my way I lived the world was like that, you know, instead of maybe sitting on a TV watching, you know, Sonny and Cher.
Right.
You know, yeah. Even when we lived in Scenic Park, you know, we would take our bikes right down to the end of the street. We'd be at the forest, Chickasha Forest, and we would, you know, collect raspberries and rose hips and make our own quote unquote tea. You know, with probably like moose turds in it and stuff.
Of course. Did you pretty much decide what went in and what didn't go in? Or did you have a lot of help, guidance with that, with an editor?
I had amazing help. I had an amazing editor at Dial Press named Jen Smith. And she was the one. What happened was we ended up with a 350-page word manuscript, which was too long. And we struggled with it for over a year trying to fix it and make it faster. And the institute just suggested we take 120 pages out, take out the entire middle of the book.
Ouch.
And that was hard. But I learned something, and, you know, it had to do with that idea of radical change, you know, that really, I don't think you can take a mediocre thing and make it great. I just think that when you're in a mediocre thing, you'll make little steps and you'll try and think, oh, maybe if I make these little steps, I'll get to something good. But you're not going to get to great. I mean, to get to great, you got to go from 12 o'clock to 6 o'clock. You really do. And so I just yanked out those pages. And then I said, okay, what do we have left? Well, we've got my dad's divorce and my divorce right next to each other.
Interesting.
And then we'll just fold in some connecting material so it's not out of hand. And it ended up being that also is the point, right? How a childhood experience can inform your adult. And I didn't even know I was making that point until we ripped out the fat.
Well, unfortunately, we only have a couple of minutes left. I can't believe how fast this hour has flown by. It's been really great to have you here with us. I wanted to just get one question in about your current job because it's so intriguing.
Oh, thanks.
You're the deputy editor and head of books coverage for Oprah.com. Describe that a little bit for us. We got about a minute and a half.
Sure. You know, what I do at Oprah is I write a weekly column. So I write essays that are on Oprah.com each week. And then I also select the books that we cover for the week and for the month on Oprah.com, which I sometimes work with O Magazine, but we're two separate entities. I also work a lot with O Network. And it's really exciting, incredible job. And I get to often work with incredible authors, you know, Toni Morrison, Maya Angelou, Jeffrey Eugenides on essays that they write specifically for us to, you know, where they talk about personal experiences in a really fresh and exciting way and get to read books and cover them and then get to write essays that I hope are sort of funny and, you know, helpful to people in their day to day, which is what I do want to do. And it's a wonderful creative job. It's a demanding job. It's a job that demands that I get there at 9 o'clock. And that means writing is at 4 o'clock in the morning before the kids get up.
And are you writing another book now?
Yes.
Yay.
Quietly.
Can you give us any inkling into what it's about?
It's a novel and it takes place in Alaska.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, there you have it, folks. A novel that takes place in Alaska. So this is a foray back into fiction.
We will see.
Okay.
If I don't chicken out, I am like really drawing on all my powers of being afraid but acting anyway, which is what I call courage.
Any idea when it's going to be?
No. I can't even do that. I have to work. I can't even work page to page on this one. It's like sentence to sentence. It's it's adjective to noun to verb.
Well, thank you so much, Lee.
It's a pleasure.
Lee Newman has been my guest. Her book is Still Points North. You should rush out and get a copy because it is a great read. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks for tuning in and for the call today. Thanks to Lee Newman for sharing her story with us. Thanks to Kristen Spack for engineering and womaning the phones. She doesn't man them. Next week, join host Kathleen McCoy to talk about the Anchorage Music Co-op. Thanks so much for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.